Welcome back to Pete's Grit. I'm Zach Hodges.
And I'm Al Shanklin.
And today we have part two on all things point-of-care ultrasound in the pediatric ICU.
Yes. We're talking with Dr. Thomas Conlin and Dr. Sarah Ginsberg. Dr. Conlin is a pediatric intensivist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he serves as the Director of Pediatric Critical Care Ultrasound. His research centers all things point-of-care ultrasound, and we are so impressed by how he's built and maintained their program.
Yes, and we're also happy to have Dr. Ginsberg back with us on the program. She's an assistant professor of pediatrics and a practicing pediatric intensivist at Children's Medical Center Dallas and UT Southwestern. Her professional and research interests include clinical applications of POCUS in the pediatric ICU. She's very active both locally and nationally to improve POCUS skills for pediatric intensivists, including participating in the Pediatric Research Collaborative on Critical Ultrasound, a subgroup of Palisi.
Yes, this is such an interesting series. Let's get right to the content.
So you guys have done a great job taking a very complex topic and making it simple for us. But I imagine attendings out there maybe who didn't train with point-of-care ultrasound, it's a big task to pick up. And do we have any data on how prevalent or what proportion of pediatric intensives actually use POCUS on their bedside assessment?
It's limited. I'll quote, actually, Thomas did a survey of fellowship programs now a few years ago, and asking them, do they use POCUS? And again, this is not just the centers, it's the fellowship programs themselves. And about two-thirds of the respondents said that there is some version of training in clinical use. But I think the problem is that we haven't really defined what training or what clinical use actually means. And when you dug deeper into that paper, a lot of the structural components that are really necessary for a sustained POCUS program didn't exist. And I think that's prevalent in pediatric ICUs across the country. And I think that's really where we are right now in sort of pediatric critical care across the board and incorporating POCUS. I think the pediatric ER was the first on the uptake. I think setting the example from their adult colleagues. And now we're learning from both pediatric and adult ER and internal medicine about of what to do. So I'd say that I think there's a lot of people interested, but in terms of programs that have all what you would say like core components of a program, credentialing, storing, documentation, QA, I don't think that many places have it. In full transparency, we're still working on it here in Dallas. And I'm still learning from the example that Thomas and Akira set at CHOP. And so I think the hard part is that it requires both sustained infrastructure and sustained use. Again, Thomas puts on a great course in Philly, which I think we'll talk about later in terms of options for people to learn. But he can show from his data that everyone goes to a course, they get super excited, they'll listen to this podcast, they'll be like, POCUS is the best, we're going to POCUS. And then they go back to their individual institutions where there isn't really a support system yet. And then the use, the interest falls off dramatically after they leave the environment where POCUS is flowing and easy, not easy, but readily available. And so I think all of that, and again, I'm learning being the champion here in Dallas, being the first champion is hard. And I think that's where I think a lot of people are working at this time. And we'll talk about kind of resources moving forward. But it's the sustained infrastructure and the sustained use that really allows for a POCUS program to develop, whether you're an academic or small centers. And I think that's where getting that activation energy and sustaining that activation energy is the biggest jump that people are struggling with over kind of across the board.
Oh, yeah. Would you say that a core component that's a big motivator and a big deterrent is the ability to actually put the images into a patient chart so that other people can open them and say, oh, your view isn't very good, this looks like this to me, and talk about it and things like that?
Absolutely. You know, there are many different ways. There are third-party programs. A lot of emergency medicine programs use third-party programs where essentially you get the clip, it uploads to a cloud that's secure-ish, and then you're able to access that. I think there's a lot of issues. And before anyone would jump into that, you know, you really need to work with what is your academic center going to allow and incorporate and be safe. And that is exploding exponentially with the use of handheld machines as well, because you can just kind of click and upload and all of that. But the infrastructure is hard. Again, speaking from personal experience, where, you know, I've been here since 2019. We've been trying to figure that out the whole time. It's not an easy question. I'm learning more and more involving very complex working groups, essentially. And Thomas can kind of speak to his experience actually being successful at it. But I think that at the minimum, you record on the machine, because once it's saved on the machine, it's recorded, it's a concrete image, and then we can do stuff with it. But you're right that if it doesn't go beyond the machine, people aren't going to be like, oh yeah, POCUS is really great and I want to do that too. So I do think that the dissemination, because it allows both for patient care, but it also allows for teaching and QA and looking through images, is really one of the biggest branch points, but takes a ton of work. And there are ways to build up a program while that's still in process.
And I think Sarah said it nicely. She's a superstar trainee here and recognized that she was going to be going to start something new, but had value to it. And her statement that, well, we're still working, you know, to try to get things up that I've been successful at developing. My program, our program here, which is, you know, now over a decade old, I guess, we are still put together with Band-Aid and duct tape, you know, and things change over time, right? The way that our IT systems work to be able to even put images into the medical record, it takes a team of people to be able to do that. And so early on for us, we started with just jump drives. And we took images and we put them onto jump drives and we did review sessions with them and we had paper documentation and we had to figure out, do we put this into the medical record and talk about doing the point of care study or do we not do that? And so everybody's at a different place. But, you know, Sarah sort of talked about with that paper is we're not reinventing the wheel here. It's already been done as far as what needs to happen for program sustainability and for this longitudinal process. The American College of Emergency Medicine has put out really beautiful guidelines that talk about the infrastructure that is necessary for a sustainable program to make it actually effective. And the kind of five components to that is kind of building a curriculum, having image upload capabilities, having documentation processes, having a quality assurance process, having a credentialing type of platform. Those things are really hard to do, but there is value in doing them for patients, for providers, for institutions. And so the goal for people like Sarah and myself is to try to figure out how to simplify that. Now, that's like the unsexy stuff about ultrasound that, you know, is really boring to people, but it's really fascinating to me how to get people to do something new. And it's not just ultrasound, right? You have any new technology that's out there that you think is powerful, that you think is going to improve care, like you want to get it out there, but you have to be careful about what you do because people are watching. And so we really kind of are thinking about like, how do we do this the right way? And ultrasound is sort of a new thing that's out there that people are just kind of figuring out. And so I think kudos to Sarah for all that she's done and kind of kudos to all the people out there that are trying to do this because we know that they're out there. We are a relatively small community of people who are interested in this sort of stuff. And we try to support each other. We all kind of know each other's names across the various institutions in trying to figure out. But the reality is, going back to the first question of how many people are doing it, a lot of people are doing it. Like the kids are doing it, okay? And the adults have to sort of figure out, like, how do we protect the kids? Because it's not going to stop. Because the information that you're getting is powerful. The information is high-quality information. And so we on the back end have to think through the processes to make this safe for patients, providers, and for institutions. But 60% was quoted from, you know, a couple of years ago. It's only going to go higher.
Nice. I have to ask specifically, in Philly, you're working at an Epic Center. Are you doing scanner to HIPAA compliant, like separate drive that people look in, or have you integrated it all the way into the EMR?
So it's in the EMR. So our system, and again, it's been worked out for, it's taken a lot of years, right? And there are some things that this gets really off into the weeds, but there are some things that I'm happy to talk about, how to sort of help make that happen and kind of words that you can use to get people motivated to do that sort of stuff. But our system is that we can place an order in Epic, that our machines will query those orders, that we can get the patient information onto those machines, do the study, link to the patient, upload the images into Epic, and then we have a way of doing an interpretation for those studies that's within Epic that our team of credentialed faculty can. So it's great, but it's taken a lot of years to do it. And trust me when I say that it is imperfect. But at least, you know, we practice in this Swiss cheese model of kind of safety. Like, that's what these infrastructural elements are, right? They're just another layer of Swiss cheese, not perfect, but to make sure that people are doing the right things, to make sure that we're getting good images, and then hopefully we're able to feed back a little bit to the learners, you know, what you did right, what you did wrong, and that's it. That's a huge topic.
Wow. That's an incredible accomplishment.
Yeah, I agree. And Thomas talked about all of those parts of what it takes to build a successful POCUS program. And so I wouldn't call it the holy grail because it's accomplishable, but it's the end goal is integration into the EMR with interpretation. But for everyone else out there that's trying to build a program, if someone offered you the ability to upload images into Epic without having the other structural support, I'd say don't take it. And when I first was like, Thomas, I can't upload, he's like, that gives you time to build everything else. And I've really realized that over the past couple of years, because if you don't have a credentialing process and a documentation process and a review process, as soon as you go into the chart, and this kind of builds to thoughts about legal risk, as soon as you put into the chart, you're really exposing yourself and you need to be sure about it. If you didn't know how to describe a heart sound, we would look at the cardiology note or something like that. That's what I do. But like, you can't just operate without the support underneath. And so the getting into the chart is one of the biggest steps that, again, I'm hoping to help expose people and lead to a boom in the program. But there really has to be a lot of support behind that. And so even if you are like, I want to start a POCUS program, and then they're like, okay, we can put in Epic tomorrow. Now, having gone through the process and still working through the progress, I realized that that actually wouldn't have been the right thing for the program and probably not the right thing for the patients either.
Oh, wow. So interesting.
Interesting to me is that I feel like we're going to see POCUS become more and more the standard of care. I see it now as being the standard of care when I place an IJ line, right? I mean, I wouldn't do it without ultrasound. And I'm interested to see how that changes the standard of care in other areas. And question here, like, when you think about training fellows, has it been defined exactly what POCUS skills we should teach them by the end of their fellowship? I mean, time is and resources are so short.
We don't have a great definition of what a basic curriculum looks like. We do have a small group kind of published some international guidelines on pediatric critical care and neonatal point of care ultrasound guidelines that I was one of the co-authors on. But I can honestly say that, like a lot of other guidelines, it doesn't have a lot of teeth to it. There's not a lot of data to sort of support the applications and indications. I can give you my general gist of what I think a critical care fellow needs to know, right? Needs to know all applications across procedures, how to follow a needle tip in, and then how to identify landmarks for procedures to be able to do it, right? To identify the diaphragm. I can teach you how to find a diaphragm in literally 15 seconds. And if that prevents you from putting a chest tube into the abdomen, like, that's a big win. And that's a very easy thing to do. And I don't need you to see your needle go into the thoracic cavity to do the drainage procedure. Just don't put the chest tube in the abdomen. That's great. All other vascular access types of stuff, like, it is an absolute game changer. And it's fine for IJs, but if you can put in a peripheral IV on a difficult access patient, you can do any procedure and be master of that procedure. Lumbar punctures are my new thing. Like, I will not send a patient down to IR. And even if it's an obese patient, or if it's a neonate, or there are things that can help guide you in lumbar punctures. And I've been incredibly successful with some basic stuff. When I kind of poo-pooed it early on, like, oh, I can do lumbar puncture. Well, no, like, actually, these basic procedures that we think we're really good at, we're just not that good at. So procedural stuff, like, that's just a given that that's going to be standard of care. I think from a lung ultrasound standpoint, identification of an effusion and identification of a pneumothorax, right? Those are some core things. From a hemodynamic standpoint, Sarah already sort of told you the basics of that, but it gets back to just kind of like six views and five questions that you're really answering for cardiac type of stuff. And being able to say that if it doesn't answer a question, then we need to refer to gold standard imaging or gold standard consultation for that question. And then when you get into the abdomen, there are pretty limited things, right? Knowledge of what abdominal fluid looks like is useful because you can see a drain. And when a surgeon is sort of saying, no, it's draining just fine, and you say, no, look at the picture, there's a lot of fluid that's sitting around the drain, right? Like, that's just an easy way of sort of doing it. So not necessarily incorporating it in trauma, but understanding free fluid in the abdomen and what it looks like. And then I've found that bladder assessments, right? Bladder is a very simple spherical structure, right? Where is the Foley catheter, right? And like as a fellow, right, what is like the call that you dread the most at night, right? My patient hasn't urinated in 8 hours. Can you please sort of tell me what to do? And it's like a basic question of like, well, okay, well, give them fluid, give them Lasix, give them, and you sort of pick and choose that thing, but you can just put a probe on and pretty easily identify whether or not a bladder's full, a bladder's empty, whether there's a Foley that's in there. And so I think that those to me are really some of the basic stuff and the starting points. So in the thorax and the cardiac hemodynamic stuff, and in the abdomen, where you would start from a diagnostic standpoint. But to go back to kind of what you were saying, like, you know, the ACGME, like, that's the natural pathway for this. And we do need to sort of make these definitions. And as a larger group, we do it, plan on doing it, because the ACGME is already incorporating it in training for emergency medicine, right? Residency level type stuff for adult critical care, already in there. And we're already seeing some board questions that are coming out that are associated with ultrasound. And so it's a natural step for us to have this as part of fellowship training.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, and we'll stay tuned for that.
I think to almost make a controversial point or thought question is what is, I think it gets back to kind of some of the basics in like education. What is competency? Because, you know, you guys are going to graduate fellowship and your program director and your division chair are going to sign a letter saying you are competent in placing an IJ. How many does that mean? What is competent in IJ? What is competent in a chest tube, a more rare procedure? How many intubations? You know, none of that's actually like fully defined. And so I think all of that is hard to wrap your head around. One of my co-fellows did a project on what is competency for residency bag mask? Like we say, it's like one of those, you know it when you see it, but like, what does that actually mean? You know, and so I think the competency is always a hard thing to wrap your head around because it's ill-defined across the board in terms of at least critical care, if not probably all of medicine.
Yes.
I think the question of competency is the one that comes up quite a bit. And we can tie it into sort of the legal type of question because that's where it raises its head. And as Sarah says, that is the controversial part about a lot of this. It is a new technology, so everybody wants you to demonstrate competency in your trainees. How do you get at that? But when most everything that we do in medicine has no good assessment of competency at its base. And that when we talk about like things like, you know, your OSCE at the end of your medical school or rather whatever it was, right? That was really the test to tell you, yeah, you're okay to do this, right? Is that really what that was? Or was that kind of a money grab? Like, no offense. But, you know, and we think about that too. And you think about these societies that are promoting tests to make sure that we're competent in the things that we do. And they've done it for the adult critical care side about these critical care echo. And they've created between the National Board of Echocardiography and Society of Critical Care Medicine a test to sort of say that you're a certified. Like, do we really need a test for figuring out that you can see like whether a heart's squeezing or not? Because that's really what we're trying to get at. You know, it's like when people come in and want to talk about autonomy and stuff. Like, it's a complicated topic. There's a lot more to it than just saying somebody's competent or not, and goes into a little bit of the weeds. But
oh, yeah. I am curious because I remember interacting with it in our emergency department, but what does the quality assessment, what do you consider standard of care for quality assessment, quality assurance, having someone who's formally trained overread things?
So it basically just means that you have somebody that knows what they're talking about, looking at your stuff and being able to figure out a way to provide that feedback. Now, you can have formal type of stuff, right? So like when I trained in ultrasound, our emergency medicine people next door were really the only people who were doing this. And so I'd go to their review sessions, I'd bring my jump drive and I'd show them the images and they'd give me some commentary and we'd look over some other images that they would have and talk about stuff. Now, we've gone to the point where since everything's in the medical record, you know, I have to email people, or there's a red cap system that we've set up to provide feedback if learners go back to that system. But it just means that, you know, in your local institution, finding a friend, meaning that could be a cardiologist. If you want to do cardiac studies and you're interested in learning how something works, okay, like here are my pictures. What do I need to do a little bit better? But also those people need to understand what your purpose is. And so you're not trying to be a cardiologist. You're not trying to look at the same things. And so your global question is this. It is in the context of this. And this is the image that I got to answer that question. That was the big thing to overcome, because our cardiology group early on, when we first set this up, they're like, we need to see all your images because we need to make sure that you're doing this the right way. And so we set it up with the chair of the echocardiography lab, and she, and I was deathly afraid of her because she's a, you know, wonderful, wonderful human being, but like, she's chair of the echocardiography lab. I'm in like a late fellow, early faculty, and she'd look at my images and she would just roll her eyes. She'd be like, what is this? Like, this is awful. This is terrible. And I'd tell her the clinical story, and she'd be like, oh, that's awful. Like, what happened to this kid? And you're like, well, you know, they died. Like, it's a horrible death. Like, and she's like, that's terrible. Like, what are these patients that you're seeing? And I recognize that our cardiologists don't actually look at that many kids with two ventricles, you know, or don't look at kids that have the clinical processes that we are looking at a day in and day out basis. So when we share with them the stories, they understand what it is that we're actually trying to do. And so she came to the understanding that, oh, like, your image quality is not perfect in this, but your question was, is the heart just squeezing okay? And yeah, it's squeezing okay. And so her frame completely shifted as well. And so she became interested in not only the stories, but in looking at images in a different way. And so when you sort of ask the question about, like, well, what's your quality assurance process? Early on, it was like, all the images, we quality assure. Now we're at a point where, you know, we review a couple of the interesting cases in a monthly session, and then we're always over-reading on our system and trying to provide feedback to our trainees. But that oversight is loosened now that we feel that the quality of images are good, our interpretive capacity is good. So there is no firm and fast, like, this is how you need to do quality assurance. Early on, you want to be a little bit more regimented in it. You want to be transparent about it so that people understand what it is that you're doing and understand why you're doing it. And then over time, it's going to change. And as your technologic capabilities, like, we're right now at a bad point from our technologic capabilities for doing QA, that's made us have to adjust what we're doing. So there's no right way. We do want to standardize the stuff that we're doing, but it's dependent upon what you're trying to do, what your institution looks like, who your friends are within those institutions, where those communications have come. So that's a long-winded question or answer. Difficult question.
No, thank you.
I think the first step from people trying to build a program, I think both from a medical, legal, and from a QA perspective, is start saving your images. Because sometimes your patients are really sick. You're like, I got the clip. I got to go. I got to do this thing. You just got to hit clip. Because every machine, regardless of the machine, regardless of whether it's 20 years old, is going to be able to manually save on the machine. So you've got to start saving your images as soon as you start doing POCUS for diagnostic. And then figure out a way to store your images. And it might be manual downloads, kind of everything like that. But get the first step of getting it saved on your machine, first and foremost, as you're starting, and then figure out how to get it from the machine to elsewhere. And it's probably not going to be the final product on that first round. But at least if you start saving, you've made the biggest step, I think, in the initial process.
Nice.
And a couple of things I gather for quality assurance: keep everything focused on improving the care of the patient. Always seeking to be iteratively improving your process to improve patient care, and also be collaborative. Who are those friends that are going to help you? Will it be cardiology, radiology? Might be different based on your site, but be collaborative with the experts that are available to you.
The only way you're going to get, or I mean, you know, there are lots of ways of getting in trouble in life, but one of the big ways that you're going to get in trouble with point of care ultrasound is if it looks like you're trying to sneak around, right? If you're not being transparent about what you're doing, if you're just trying to put a probe on, nobody knows what you're doing, nobody's kind of authorized you to go there. So that's why you really want, from a divisional level, you want your kind of leadership to have bought into this. So if you're going to put a probe on and look at the heart, then your boss needs to know, I'm going to start looking at the heart. There are some things that go with us trying to look at the heart. So we need to talk to the people who typically look at the heart to make sure that everybody's aware that we're going to start doing this. And now you're going to have to help, you know, we'll figure out a way to be safe. But that transparency is really important. And so everybody wants you to learn. Everybody wants you to learn new things that's going to improve patient care. But really, that component of transparency with your leadership is really important. This goes to fellows out there who may be just taking courses, and maybe the individual who is going to lead an ultrasound program in your local place, right? This is actually a great time and a great opportunity for fellows to learn a new thing that is going to be valuable to your institution. So as you're thinking about transitioning from fellowship to being an attending, and you're going through that interview process, trust me, it is a feather in your cap if you sit across the table and you say, yeah, I'm interested in point of care ultrasound. Because places are looking for that right now. They want to be moving forward in this. They just need people to do it. And you know, Sarah was all in, right? She was in from the start. She's got co-fellows who were not all in, who still did the training, still got buy-in for it. And now as they're, interestingly, as their careers have sort of evolved in different institutions, because they knew ultrasound from coming from here, they're now the leaders of their ultrasound program. Now, maybe begrudgingly or whatnot, but just as people who are interested in this and who are passionate about it, go talk to your leadership, say, hey, this is something that I'm interested in. You'll probably get feedback that, oh, that's cool. That is actually a direction that we're looking to go in. And so if you're looking for faculty positions, it's an extra little thing that may help.
You know, Zach and I are looking for faculty positions and we agree with you. We are, our objective is to be as useful for the division as possible.
That's,
you know,
that's what the divisions are looking for too. So that's good.
Alice and I always get great mentorship every recording. We always learn new things about how to improve our own career. I wanted to unpack, made a couple of suggestions about legal concerns. You know, we're not attorneys. We don't give legal advice. But to briefly unpack, just for as a means of awareness, you know, what legal concerns might a physician bring upon themselves in incorporating POCUS in their physical assessment?
This is a great question that is complicated in many ways, but it's not complicated in other ways. I was invited to write an article for the European Journal of Pediatrics on anything that I wanted. And it's awesome because to get an invitation like that, because you can write about whatever you want. And so I ended up digging around this whole question about medical legal risk. And I can guarantee you that probably 100% of people have not read this manuscript. But I had a super fun time actually writing it, which is important in your job satisfaction to enjoy what you do. There is actually literature on point of care ultrasound and medical legal risk. There are three papers that are out there. I believe that two in adults and one in pediatrics, but I'd have to go look. There have been zero documented lawsuits for integration of point of care ultrasound in clinical practice. There have been lawsuits when point of care ultrasound was available, but was not used. And so that is kind of a thing that makes you sort of step back and say, well, actually, I might be at more risk as things, just like you alluded to, Zach, as things become more and more standard of care. Like, I need to actually learn how to do this if this is going to become my standard. From beyond that sort of perspective, we know that risk is sort of a forward-thinking thing, right? So you're never not at risk in our job. One-third of all of us are going to have a lawsuit. That's just the reality of modern medicine in the United States. It's one of the few jobs in the world where you can do everything right and somebody dies, right? That's a hard reality to deal with. And there are a lot of things that you can get sued for that, you know, that's just what we accept. That's why we have insurance. That is part of practice. And you know what? The reality is that we also do wrong things. Right? And the medical legal system is there to make sure that it protects patients. And so what we can do to overcome that risk, right? Point of care ultrasound, there's no doubt that there is risk within. There are a lot of different risks from not only the machines, but to the providers that employ it in the right way with the right indications and get the right sort of follow-up with it. But there are things that we can do to help mitigate that risk. And the things that you can do is just what Sarah talked about. It is set up the infrastructure to have kind of those extra layers of Swiss cheese, right? You have somebody that is capable. You have a division that has a couple people that are interested in point of care ultrasound that overlook each other's studies, that have a platform to help develop the training in what you're doing. It has a QA process. It has medical documentation, right? Like the kid that comes in with and dies of heart failure that had a point of care ultrasound done when they initially presented, and that point of care ultrasound was called as normal, right? If you're on the jury stand and they say, well, they died of cardiac failure, like it wasn't clearly normal. Well, if you've got a picture that's saved that showed normal function at that point in time, right, that helps you, right? But if you just documented in the medical record that I did a point of care ultrasound and the function was normal, like that's a problem. A process of documentation, a process of credentialing, like all of those things help to mitigate risk. It doesn't take it away entirely, but it helps to mitigate it. And the thing that I'll also say is that you have to recognize your practice setting, right? We practice in the United States, very different from other places as far as medical legal risk. We practice in pediatrics, which it's not so recent anymore, but out of the 25 specialties that were looked at for medical legal risk, we were ranked 24 out of the 25 for actual risk. So we're at a pretty low risk population. The challenge for us is that when we get sued, we are the number one as far as payouts for legislation. So what I ultimately say is that it is ultrasound in general is a very low risk intervention, but it is not a no risk intervention. And the way that you can prevent other bad things from happening is to try to build up that infrastructure as best as you can. But just like with everything, we can always live and practice out of fear. But what we really are called to do is to treat the patient and help the patient. And above and beyond everything else and the legal and stuff, do what's right for them. And if putting a probe on the chest to diagnose tamponade because you clinically suspect it right there, but you're undertrained and you're not quite sure, and the factor that's precluding you from picking up a probe is the question about whether I'm going to get sued, like that shouldn't be the driving force behind the decision.
Excellent. Well, Sarah and Thomas, I really appreciate this conversation about both POCUS and how US PICUs are built. This is really informative, honestly. If there's a fellow or early career attending who's listening, who really wants to get involved, help build this for their program, what would you recommend they take advantage of?
So we've talked a lot about how it's going to take an early adopter or a champion at each location, each institution. And so if you are interested in making yourself the champion, the first thing you're going to have to do is acquire the skills. And so there are national courses. Thomas puts one on at CHOP. There are SCCM courses. There might be kind of more regional courses. You can be, I think, creative about who is teaching them. So I think there are a limited number of pediatric specific courses, but there are probably a lot more adult local courses that you could take. And so I think you need to take a course. You need to build those skills. And it's great if you do it at a pediatric specific course, but you could also just take advantage of the local content experts. And so if that's your ped emergency department, that's great. If that's your adult emergency department, which I think is even more common, start, like Thomas said, going to their reviews, because most adult major emergency rooms are going to have a very comprehensive image review system. So partner with adult emergency medicine, partner with pediatric emergency medicine, partner with cardiology, so that you can have kind of local image review and sustained exposure. Because again, even if you go to a course, that's great, but how are you going to keep that up locally? You're going to have to find essentially partners, and it's likely going to have to be a partner outside of your division. So I think really take advantage, especially of emergency medicine expertise, is a really a great way to go. There are many websites online for image review and brief teaching. Core Ultrasound or 5-Minute Sono does a ton of different really brief 5-minute lecture clips. And I'm not affiliated with that, but I send residents and fellows to that all the time. And then something I am affiliated with, but am by no means the driver, there's an online lecture series put on by Eric Sue, who's currently at Texas Children's. He is a huge force in POCUS and in bedside ultrasound. It's put on through the Percuss group, which is the ultrasound subgroup of Palisi, but you do not need to be a member for that. But every 2 weeks for the entire year, he's having experts give essentially hour-long lectures on all sorts of applications of POCUS, essentially from head to toe. And so you can join that lecture series, or you can go to their, I think he's archiving it on YouTube. So even if you can't make the lecture series, you could go back and see any of those lectures on your time. I think all of those are ways to gain skills, but I think the most important thing is how do you sustain it? And that's really going to be continuing to do it at the bedside and finding someone to partner with that can help you both just sustain and grow those skills so that you can become the local champion and then start to disseminate.
I'll just echo a couple of things that Sarah said. So from a societal level, or for a larger community level, Society of Critical Care Medicine has a work group that is point of care ultrasound for pediatrics that you get into that group. If you just sort of email them, again, what Sarah said, the Percuss group, which is run by Eric Sue, who's a good friend and really the OG of it all, who really does a nice job of continuing the community. Anybody out there is welcome to just email me directly at conlant@chop.edu, because I know the struggles that you're going through. I know most everybody that's out there, and I can connect you with the people who are at the same point of the struggles or who have overcome the struggles. We all know each other and want to help each other. And just to sort of echo what Sarah said, again, we have wait lists for our courses that are very large, which means that we now are trying to develop out more courses. So now we'll have courses at Stanford and Austin. There are lots of different course opportunities. Again, you can reach out to me if you want to know them. Some are CHOP affiliated, some are not. And they're all taught by very similar people that are experienced in this. We also will offer local training. So if you have a group of like 20 to 30 learners that are within your institution, oftentimes it's neonatologists and critical care people who are interested in this, we can come and deliver a local course for 2 days on training. We actually like to do that because that really gets people moving rather than an individual getting trained and going back. That means that there's an investment from an entire departmental or divisional level that we think is probably a little bit better for implementation than just individuals. So as I say, we're a small community, but we're nimble in that way and being able to connect people.
And building on that is one last point. I know this podcast has an international community. Thomas and his crew has traveled internationally to help. So don't let location be the barrier.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yes. We'll be sure to share citations for the papers referenced and all the resources that you guys have shared. Thomas, feel free to email me any additional information and we can include that in the description. And to wrap up our conversation today, Dr. Thomas Conlon, Dr. Sarah Ginsberg, we have had so much fun having you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for your time. We are very excited to share this message with our audience.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @critpeds and @pedscrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.